This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Oops, he's run off. Hang on. He's going to run to, he's running to the pond.
Mark's just gone to chase Bob, who's gone to the pond.
Bob, come here. That was good.
This week on Walking the Dog, I went for a stroll with actor, writer, comedian, director. I could go on, but we have a podcast to do. So let's just say the endlessly talented phenomenon that is Mark Gatiss. Mark met me on London's Hampstead Heath with his gorgeous Labrador, Bob, who it's fair to say was a little speedier than my Shih Tzu, Ray, a bit like the Lewis Hamilton to Ray's milk float. Mark, as you'd expect, is a fascinating and incredible person to go for a stroll with. He told me all about his childhood growing up in the Northeast and his family dogs Whiskey and Brandy, his decision to go to drama college, which led to the utterly brilliant League of Gentlemen. And don't worry, we also obviously discussed his collaboration with Stephen Moffat on the award-winning Sherlock. We chatted too about what makes Mark tick as a person, how he sometimes struggles to say no, his experience of coming out, and also how he dealt with loss. I kind of expected Mark to be funny and charming, but I guess I was really struck by what a kind, gentle person he seemed. But look, the man's got a Labrador. That was a bit of a spoiler alert. I adored my walk with Mark, and I really hope you do too. If so, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. I'll shut up now and hand over to the man himself. Here's Mark and Bob. This is going to be an exciting
walk. So what
walk.
We used to do once we get past the Lido is let him off.
Come on, Ray.
And then he goes bananas.
Look, so. You see, look at this, Mark.
Bob, I must tell you, will move speedy.
That's why we have to let Bob's soul sing openly.
Yes.
And he has to do his own thing. Come on, Ray. You can follow behind me and Mark.
Why Ray?
I liked the idea of having an old pub regular's name.
Yes.
I like Raymond. And then in a little, I suppose there's a slight burst of sentiment because it's my late sister's name was Rachel and we called her Ray.
Oh, that's nice.
And I thought it was a way for her kids to sort of, it's a nod to her without it feeling a bit over the top,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
I didn't want to give him her full name, might be a bit weird.
it's a vexed issue though, isn't it? I mean, our old dog was called Bunsen. And that was that came about because when I was a kid, we had a West Highland Terrier, and I remember the, it's 1973. I remember the preparation for getting a dog was so exciting, and I thought, well, we can call the dog, you know, Winston or something interesting, and we got the dog, and of course my dad decided we call Whiskey, and then a few years later, Whiskey ran away whilst on heat and got up the duff by this rangy mongrel up the street called Shane and had a litter which all died except one, and we kept the survivor, and I thought now we can call the dog something interesting. The dog was therefore called Brandy, and so we had Whiskey and Brandy for a while. So I always said that when I had a dog of my own I'd give it an interesting name like Bunsen, and so that's what happened. But when we got Bob,
we
went through the whole
process,
the naming process again of, and it was my partner Ian's turn, really. But we went through all kinds of things. We thought about Plum Bob. And then I thought, what are we doing? And then weirdly, as soon as he arrived, he was just obviously Bob. He's just a Bob.
I have some questions for you, Ree Bob, but I've just realised, Mark, because
I'm going to let him off now.
Possibly the world's greatest storyteller. You've already told me this wonderful story about dogs and your history of them, and I haven't even introduced you.
Oh yeah,
so
we can re-edit this.
This is Walking the Dog. Normally at this point I would list the person's profession,
all the things they did, the things that had made them celebrated and well-known, but we don't have 2.5 hours to do that. I'm with the very wonderful Mark Gatiss. I say Gatiss, that's right, isn't
that's
it?
That's right.
Do some people say Gatiss?
Yes. Those who are dead to me. You did. That was very good, because I was... what I usually have to do at this point is we have to go back and do it again. So that's gone very well.
It's a good start, Mark, isn't it?
A good start. You know, the strange thing is I find, is when people get a bit funny about it, as if you're sort of saying, you know, people make them, it's something like, you know, they've accidentally put milk in your tea and you go, all right. It's like, it's my fucking name. Therefore I would like it to be correct. I don't think it's too much to ask. My dad's always been very hot on it. Strange thing happened. My uncle George emigrated to Australia in the 50s. And he didn't come back. They lost touch. And he didn't come back until 1980. And then it turned out that in order to avoid endlessly correcting, he had allowed himself and his family to be called Gatiss. And so my cousins out there in Australia are actually called Gatiss. And my dad was incensed at this crime against history. Bob!
Where's he gone? Bob! Bob seems ever Bob. So good-natured, Mark.
He's adorable. There he is. He's a Labrador and therefore entirely made of good nature.
And he's a golden...
Silliness.
Is it called a golden Labrador or yellow
actually,
Labrador?
He's actually technically fox red. His mother was much redder.
We should say that noise is we bring someone along for the sound effects. He's sort of an out-of-work
actor. Percy Edwards. You remember, yeah. Percy Edwards used to do it in the old days. I was watching...
on the radio plays or something.
I was watching something from the 70s the day on YouTube. There was this amazingly nostalgic moment where there was obviously supposed to be a cat or something outside the room. And I thought, that's Percy Edwards, because it used to be such a distinctive sound of him doing animals. And we all, as children, we all knew it wasn't real.
And he was like a famous, what would you call him, like, voiceover sound effects?
Animal impersonator.
Yeah, animal impersonator, yeah.
Those were the days. It was also that marvellous thing, which is now totally gone, where they used to get ladies to do the voices of children. Do you remember? It went on in the Archers until about 2003. Yeah. It used to give me the creep so much. Oh, Mummy, I don't think I want to go to school today. It was so disturbing.
Oh, look at this. He's met a nice collie. This feels like the 70s, a Labrador and a collie.
Yeah, yeah. I hope it's called Lady. They used to be, didn't they? Not anymore.
They were always called Lady. What were the boy dogs called?
Shane. Genuinely Rex.
I want to go back, because I've met the wonderful Bob. I want to go back to the Gatiss, not Gatiss.
Yeah.
Childhood. Which was in the northeast. Yes. Is it Tony Blair's constituency on
yes,
there?
Yes, it was. It was one of the strangest...
Sedgefield, is it?
Sedgefield, yes. I was born in... a maternity hospital called Hardwick Hall, which is now it's a stately home, converted and now back into a hotel. It's quite a swanky place to have been born, although it wasn't at the time. I've only been back once, and they'd just done it up, landscaped everything, and I went up to the reception and say, I was born here, can I have a wee? And they let me, so that was good. But Sedgefield, I was born there, and then we moved to a place called Trimden. My dad was a colliery engineer, and then we moved. He changed jobs and became a chief engineer in a mental hospital, and we moved to this place called School Aycliffe, which is where my dad still is.
Oh, okay.
Is Ray particularly interested in other dogs or not? Because Bob has a strange...
Bob.
He's really much more interested in the ball. But it's like people, isn't it? There's some dogs he has chemistry with, and he just goes nuts.
Really?
He has a friend called Whiskey, who's sort of his girlfriend, and they're crazy about each other. And you know, as soon as they see each other, something clicks, which is
yes.
different.
It's weird. Ray has that with Dennis, the Chihuahua.
Yes.
So your dad was, he was from a family of miners, yeah.
Yes. My dad and my uncle Harry were the first not to actually go down the pit. I mean, they did. They went. He tells me still about these amazing things. He used to go down as. In his engineering capacity, but not actually digging. Whereas my grandfather and his father before him, and all the way back, I think, to the Bronze Age, they were proper miners.
Really?
And as a result, I mean, you look at pictures of my granddad, who died when he was 71. He looks about 100, and he died, you know, he had emphysema and all those terrible things. But I've got wonderful pictures of him and my grandma on the beach on summer holiday, and he's in a three-piece suit with a Homburg and his and his trouser turn-ups rolled up. That's his one concession to
summertime. I find them oddly moving, those pictures.
Yes.
Do you?
It's a totally different life. I mean, you know, it's not untrue to say that you look at people and they had older faces. You can't believe that they look like, in fact, I was thinking this watching a bit of the Republican Party convention and looking at people who claim to be 25 and seem to have the faces of 50. That sometimes experience or evil, in that case, can actually age you. And my grandparents' generation were, they had it very rough. And,
yeah.
You know, oops, he's run off. Hang on. He's going to run to, he's running to the pond. We better get a spurt on.
You go. Mark's just gone to chase Bob, who's gone to the pond.
Bob, come here. That was good.
What happened?
Ooh, I forgot. This is where we usually put him on the lead before we approach the pond, because he always does that.
What did he do? Did he jump Ooh. In?
Yes, he's been in.
Oh, look. Anyway, where were we? So your dad... Where did he work when you were growing up then? Was he at the...
At the hospital.
The psychiatric hospital opposite you.
Yeah.
And did your mum... What, did she work or was she a homemaker?
She worked there. At first she looked after us, and then she did work at the hospital for a bit, because I used to go over there quite a lot. Well, an awful lot. But she did work there for a while. But she was a secretary in a paint factory for most of her working life. She hated it. I remember her.
She
hated it so much. She also worked at police headquarters for a while in the 50s. I've got lovely pictures of her. Again, secretarial, but it was all a sort of different stage of her life. That she used to talk. There was this man called Austin Stokoe, who was the man she nearly married, and he loomed large in my childhood. I used to think, because I used to imagine he was like a Russian prince or something.
Whoa.
Bob objected to that. What was that? We're going to go.
Was that genuinely a reaction to Austin Stokoe?
I think I must have stood in.
Because then Daddy wouldn't be here, would
That's
he?
That's true. Yes, you see, he knows.
Daddy might be a horrible daddy. And you had a brother and a sister?
Brother and a sister, yes. My brother's 3 years older than me. My sister was 7 years older. So I was an accident.
Were
I remember
you?
Being told that.
Did your parents tell you that?
Many years later, my mum took pains to say it was a very happy accident, but I remember being very shocked. I assumed it was some grand plan.
I think what I love about Bob is his constant enthusiasm. Every day is great, isn't it?
Well, you know, it's a dog's life. There is a lot to be learned from them, because they're so, you know, they have a very simple view of things. It's just eat, sleep, poo, repeat.
Yeah.
I mean, well, that's essentially all of us, but but Bob enjoys it more. I think it's very interesting. People have... I don't think you have to be a dog person or a cat person. I like cats. But I don't genuinely think you can trust someone who doesn't like dogs.
I think the same.
I think there's something wrong with them. And I don't think the same... It doesn't have to be a clear distinction between dogs and cats, but if you meet someone who doesn't like dogs, there's definitely something missing, definitely. But I've always loved labs, and my partner Ian never had a dog. They were obsessed with getting a dog. They eventually, this is so funny, my brother-in-law Neil started to drag a toilet roll hold, you know, tube, inner tube, what do you call them? Like the cardboard tube or a bog roll on a piece of string, and then his mum said, I think maybe we can get you a pet. They got a rabbit called Bluebell, but they were not allowed dogs. Ian's mum was very frightened of them.
Oh,
and,
right.
And this is the glory of dogs, because when we got Bunsen, Ian's mother was really frightened, even as a puppy. And then she became utterly obsessed with him.
Oh.
And now is like, she had a Damascene conversion. It's like St. Paul, she adores dogs. She does nothing but look at dog videos. And she loves Bob. and she adored Bunsen.
Yeah, because you lost Bunsen.
Christmas before last, yes.
Oh, Mark, I'm really sorry. That must have been awful.
But do you know, we made a conscious, difficult decision to get another one as a crossover. And although it felt disloyal, because it's like planning for the end, but it really worked. So we had Bob for about 18 months in Bunsen's declining years, and it really helped. It gave him a new lease of life. And then when Bunsen went, it was such a help that Bob was there to come home to. Otherwise, it's just like the definition of an empty nest, you know.
And
it was, it really helped, honestly. It seems mercenary, but it's a very good idea.
What kind of dog is that again, Mark, with the black mark on his eye? Is that like a...
That in the water?
Yeah, the one chasing his tail, that one.
Oh, that? Why? Yeah. It's like a sort of large... In fact, it's exactly like Bullseye, isn't it?
Bill Sykes'
dog. It's
yes.
like a large... terrier of some kind, I'm not sure.
Yes, he is like Bullseye, isn't he?
Bullseye!
Best piece of dog acting in the world is in David Lean's Oliver Twist when Bill's killed Nancy and the dog cowers. I dread to think what they were doing to it, to make it, but it's incredible that.
You've
still got this bag of poo. There's nowhere to put it.
Look at Mark.
That could be a separate podcast, carrying a bag of poo.
Tell me, who's your family life? What sort of home was it? Do you know what I mean? Was it like a noisy extrovert home, would you say? Was there a lot of laughter?
No, I wouldn't. Yes. I mean, it was very... I mean, I'm not going to overdo this, but it was very solidly working class. And the more I think about it, the more I realise how solidly working class we were. I think about this constantly whenever I'm... ask questions about, you know, what would be your last meal or so. And I always say beans on toast. And I remember going on one of those Saturday Morning Kitchen things. In fact, it was Saturday Morning Kitchen. And they were asking me about all these slightly rarefied foods. That I just thought, God, I'm so basic. I really am so basic. I can't stand so many of those things. And I fall back on my childhood favourites all the time. I really do. Mm. I had a bacon and egg sandwich the other day and I thought, do you know, this is probably the best thing in the world. Literally bar nothing. It tastes like heaven. What could be nicer? So, I mean, that's how we grew up. My dad was quite formidable. I drew a picture of him the other day, and I put it online. And my old school friend from years ago, I haven't seen for donkeys, tweeted me saying, "That's how I remember your dad. He was quite scary." And I thought, "Yes, he was. He's quite formidable, but a lovely man. Just sort of quite short-tempered, and he worked incredibly hard. I suppose we were all slightly afraid of him, but it was a very happy house. We had a great time. My brother was very shy." My sister was, I think, probably the most extrovert of us, I would say. But there was, you know, 7 years is quite a long time when you're little.
Yeah.
So I really looked up to Jill. But she seemed, I remember, I have such strong, fond memories of certain things, like she was obsessed with Bruce Lee. She went to see Enter the Dragon, which was an X, when she was 13. And I remember her getting dressed up to it. And she looks, in my memory, she looks like Jodie Foster in Taxi Driver. And she was really dolled up to try and look older. And for some reason, I was sent to collect her from the bus stop when she got back. I can remember that so well. Just literally walking up the road on my own. It was only, you know, 500 yards up the road. But to collect her from the bus when she came back. And she was wearing this red coat with a fake fur collar. So strange. I can see that now. And she was just thrilled because she'd got in. Well, they must have been blind to think she was 18.
Yeah, I think you always remember moments like that seem so huge, don't they?
It's your association with adulthood, isn't it? So
yes.
Any glimpse of something, it's exciting, but it's slightly forbidden. Yes. And therefore, of course you remember it because it's like, oh my God, this is, it's like being allowed to stay up late.
Yeah.
You don't forget those bits.
So people always do tend to dwell... understandably, I suppose, on the Mark Gatiss grew up opposite a psychiatric
yes.
hospital, etc., etc. but what I'm interested in is you being an observer, which I imagine you were and are, and that's been a big thing about your life. Have you always had that sort of I guess it's a Sherlockian trait in a way, is that you go in and don't just see the woman on the bench, you see the shoes and you notice the details and...
the bag of poo.
But you pick up nuance. Have you always been quite sort of empathetic and sensory, I suppose?
I guess. I mean, I used to, my party piece as a kid was doing impressions. And so I was very used to copying people's voices and mannerisms and stuff like that. But also because I read Sherlock Holmes from a very early age, I was obsessed with that idea of being able to do it, like all people are, I think, when they first read it. I remember going in the school bus and thinking, what can I deduce about these people? And it never seemed to work as easily as Conan Doyle. But, you know, lengths of cigarette ash or mud on people's trousers and stuff like that. But it's the idea of it is so appealing. Yeah. Stephen Moffat calls it an achievable superpower. And that's it, isn't it? You sort of think, well, you can read Superman and think that's never going to be me, but you sort of think maybe I could be Sherlock Holmes. So, yes, I mean, it's not... it was a combination between its observation and having an ear for it, I think.
Yeah.
That's what when I first encountered Alan Bennett and the reason it spoke to me so... clearly was it felt like someone had been eavesdropping on my world, and I couldn't. Same with Kez. I saw Kez at school. It was like, why are they showing us this? It's just our bloody lives. It was like a bleak documentary, especially the bit with Brian Glover as the PE teacher. So it's really having a kind of sort of empathy for and an ear for dialogue and for characteristics, I suppose.
And let's sit on that bench, Mark.
Exhausted.
I think we should for a minute. Come on.
It's a hill. It's Parliament Hill.
So were you aware of being funny, Mark, when you were a kid? Making people laugh?
Oh, yes. I guess it was a sort of... I mean, the absolute cliché is it's a sort of bullying avoidance tactic. Not that I was bullied, but it was just a good way of getting on with people, or trying to get on with people, you know. I always loved funny people and funny actors, and they were all my heroes were, you know, comics and comic teams like Python and Not the Night Front News and Leonard Rossiter, Ronnie Barker. Loved Ronnie Barker. So...
Can we sit on this one, Mark?
Yes.
Mark's so cooperative.
I'm very bad at saying no.
Are you?
Yeah. Here we are.
Are you really, Mark?
Here we are, moving benches.
Do you confront people, Mark?
No, I'm terrible. I'm better than I was, much better than I was, but it's... Again, there's an Alan Bennett line, which it struck me so profoundly, I had to sort of put the book down and sort of take a moment. It's in his diaries in Writing Home. And sometime in the 60s, I think it was Richard Avedon, the great photographer, took some pictures of him in Regent's Park and persuaded him to climb up a tree and sit under an umbrella like an owl. It's a great picture. Mm. But Avedon's assistant said to Alan, you're game, aren't you? And he wrote in his diary, I'm not at all. It's just I would do anything other than be thought difficult. And I remember I put the book down and thought, oh God, that's me. Because you know, it's true. Rather than, I hate badly behaved people so much that the idea that anyone might think I was being a bit off or snotty, I go the other way and I'm too accommodating, when I should actually just say, sorry, I'm not doing that. I'm much better than I was. But I'm terrible at saying no.
Really?
Not to projects, not to any old shit, you know, but just like, I don't want to let people down. And then you end up getting in a sort of, you get in a slight sort of fix because you overcommit or you double book yourself. And it's like, and actually just in the end, if you just say, no, I'm not doing that, it just goes away. It takes years to learn that. Absolutely.
Well, it's
years.
That thing of, I think, I never in my whole life said, I don't want to go to something. What I would say is, oh yeah, that sounds great. And then I'd spend 2 weeks thinking, right, now I need to send the next text saying, I'm not sure, I think I might be working.
Yes.
But I'll let you know. Because I'd worked out that 3 or 4 sort of stages of no were better than a cold hard no.
But it's not.
But it's not, is it?
No. And before all this, before the end of the world, I was fond of saying that my very favourite thing had become when something was cancelled. It's so true. It's like you that unexpected. What? Oh no! Oh no! Oh, brilliant! Don't have to go out. Don't have to leave the house. I've changed my mind about that now, because we literally can't do anything. But that was definitely becoming my default thing.
Would you say you were quite insular as a child?
I'm afraid I'm a terrible cliche. I'm actually a very shy person who shows off on stage and things. That's true. That I mean, I'm not. I still have sort of sometimes slight social anxiety. I'm very gregarious, and I love people. I love meeting people. I love company. But I'm also weirdly shy. I quite like to just not do things.
Yeah.
And I slightly catastrophize increasingly about something, and then you just think actually it's absolutely fine.
And were you academic, Mark?
No, no. I've got a very good memory, or I used to have, and I'm very good on certain things. Terrible at maths. I can't drive. I'm really hopeless at a lot of things. And sometimes people, it's funny, and they sort of say, "Oh, is there anything you can't do?" And I'm going, "How long have you got?" It's an extraordinary assumption. I'm very lucky. I do basically the two things I always wanted to do, which is to act and to write, and that's my job. So everything else is a bonus. But no, I'm not academic.
And that started essentially when you went to university, didn't it? I mean, in terms of, that's when you met Reese and Steve and Jeremy at this acting college. Was it a drama college in sort of Yorkshire?
Yes, it's called Bretton Hall. It was a Leeds University college, like a separate campus, and they did it was like fame. Yeah. We like to think of it. But they did two acting courses. One, which was basically for sort of...
Hard times meets fame. Mr. Gradgrind. Fame costs and rapidly.
It's that big.
Took paying for it.
Sweet. And they did theatre arts, which was meant to be like a professional acting course, and dramatic arts, which was like TIE.
Yeah.
And Steve and I were in the same year on... theatre arts, and then Reese was the year below, and then Jeremy was actually at Leeds University doing English and philosophy, and I met him about a year in. That's how it all started. But I mean, it was a kind of it was a pipe. My dream was to obviously be a working actor, and I used to say, what I'd love to do is to sort of get quite well known for something, which would then be a springboard to other stuff, and that's what happened.
Did you tell your parents, and what would their attitude have been if you'd have said, "I want to be an actor," to your teachers, let's say, or to your parents or people you were growing up with? Did that seem, yeah, why not? Was that the attitude?
No, they were. It wasn't sort of hard times. Ian. They were very supportive. They just didn't think it was feasible, and they did the classic thing of, well, you need to have something to fall back on, you need a proper job, and you could maybe do this in your spare time.
Little did they know that Sherlock would be your thing to fall back on.
It's easy to forget how much good fortune and luck and turning up does for you, because I've got lots of friends, very talented friends, who've never had the breaks, and it's not fair, but that's the way it goes, and it's easy to forget how completely unachievable it did feel. I did not long after I left, I did my first TV job, which was
not long after you left drama school.
Yeah, actually, no, that's not true. It was about two years after. And I did this. I got my first TV job, which was a thing called Harry with Michael Elphick. It was a sort of follow-up to Boone, but it was filmed and set in Darlington, which is near basically where I'm from, and they were advertising for Darlington-born or based actors only, and I thought, well, this is a good chance. So I wrote to them from my parents' address, got an audition, got the part, and I had to go, weirdly, I had to go back home to film this. And then the same casting director, Susie Bruffin, got me in for a Catherine Cookson, and I got that, and I thought, I'm on. And then I didn't work for like 2 years, because that's how it goes. But I remember distinctly sitting in a pub in Islington, and they were showing, this was about the year after, they were showing the Catherine Cook, repeating the Catherine Cookson, and I thought, at least that means I've been on the telly this year. And it was a really big thing. It was like, no, if I can keep it, even with repeats, if I'm just on the telly, then some progress is being made. You know?
Yeah.
I remember once very vividly when I was living in Leeds, just after I'd left college, and I needed a job. And I went on this like cold calling thing. And it was like Glengarry Glen Ross. There was this awful man who gave us this talk about how we had to go in there and basically hit the phones hard and all this stuff.
Yeah.
But I remember a tremendous sense of liberation because I thought, as soon as he stops talking, I'm getting the bus home. And it wasn't because I knew I was going to walk into something amazing or anything like that. I just thought, and he stopped talking and I took him to one side and said, can I have a word? I said, I am completely out of my depth. I couldn't do this in a million years and I've got to go. So I did. And I remember sitting on the bus unemployed, but happy because I thought, well, I can't do that sort of shit. And I really don't know what else. I suppose I probably would have drifted into crime I suppose something. I worked for a while for a newspaper as a film reviewer. And I worked in a kid's nursery in Leeds. I just had no idea what else I could do. I just needed to do something that didn't involve maths and and wouldn't sort of brutalise me.
So with League of Gentlemen, Mark...
Yes. Bob!
Did you sense that sort of alchemy? You know, that happens when you get in a room with someone and you think, oh, there's a connection of sort of spirits here and it's a bit like-minded and we're all on the same page.
Oh, yes, but, you know... Then everyone thinks that about every band they joined. Think this is good, isn't it? I mean, I really did think we had something, but that was no guarantee it was going to happen or work at all. And you know, we really put a lot of effort into doing those first live shows to try and prove it. And then when you get that first, I think back to some of those sort of. It was a very heady time, of course it is. You always think about that. But we had a great laugh, but also we did work very hard. And when we got the first bites of like radio producers or something coming in, it was a guy called Humphrey Barclay, who was a legendary figure. He came to see our show at the Canal Cafe Theatre. And you know, he was very encouraging. But then at the same time, he said, obviously you need at least two girls. The sketches are too long, they're too dark. You know, it's easy in retrospect to think, well, of course, how could they not know? You know, this is the thing that made it particular is not those things. We had to be very strong and really sort of think, well, no, this is what we're doing. And I think that's the only way you can make your own particular vision work and cut through is to stick to your guns like that. We did make it a very... Not exactly a sort of pact, it wasn't like Stand By Me, but we knew a lot of other comics and comic actors, and we decided we weren't going to get distracted. We weren't, if someone said, you know, here's your own show or something to one of us, we would stick to the plan.
Yeah.
And I think that's really, really worked for us. We knew some people who'd, you know, they had the first flush of, they had a TV pilot and then two of them went off and did a separate thing and it just split the focus so much they never quite got into the public consciousness. So we were very aware of keeping to the plan.
And then you were quite as well, almost forensic about creating Royston Vasey as a place, weren't you? I love the idea of you almost mapping it out.
Well, yeah, we did. I mean, that was great fun, but we all had such a shared experience of the North that we spent, you know, a long time literally mapping out and naming like the new estate. And, you know, the thing I remember the best was somewhere there was a big concrete tube full of wet pornography. and all those things we remember from playing out, you know, and it was very real to us, I suppose. And actually, because the whole idea was to come up with a vehicle to contain the characters, which up until that point, up until the radio show, had been just only vaguely connected, then it is like sort of populating a board game or something. You sort of map it out and think, right, this is where they would live. This is where that would be, and it was great fun doing that.
it retained credibility, I think, that show. You know, it just always felt like a sort of quite an art house piece in a way to me.
I guess. I mean, it, you know, there's nothing wrong with being popular, and we were very popular. It was actually an interesting thing. We toured for the first time.
Oh yeah.
And the first tour was enormous. It was like 7 months long. It was enormous. And I remember our promoter Phil McIntyre saying to us that he said this strange thing happens. He used to represent Hale and Pace, and in their heyday, their Sunday night show got like 12, 13 million viewers. But he said no one would come out and see them. He toured them. It wasn't that kind of show. Whereas our show, which at best got like 3 or 4 million, but it was a cult show and people would come. I've always remembered that. It's a strange sort of, you know, they don't necessarily translate in the same way. Mass popularity does not equal, people become sort of obsessed or really into your thing, you know. And we did have catchphrases, but we weren't trying to be conscious about them. I'm old enough to remember when Larry Grayson took over the Generation Game, and of course Brucey he just minted them every week. He was amazing at catchphrases, and they tried to give Larry Grayson some new catchphrases.
Oh, the muck in here.
No, but they were his. They were
the
real.
Original.
They
what
were
was
real.
The one?
But
they,
on, they gave him one. At the end of the conveyor belt, where he had to say, turn to camera and say, "What a lot she's got," and it didn't work, and they dropped it after about 3 weeks because it just wasn't working. And I thought, well, if you try and force it on people, they won't have it.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
League just opened up. I love it. I sound like an old actor saying league. I mean, league, love.
I did the dream in 37. And...
But that just meant you could do pretty much anything you wanted,
no.
Presumably. Really?
No, I mean, and this continues to this day. These things just don't happen. And I remember a wonderful interview with Ian McDiarmid where someone said, what would you say? What advice would you give to your 16-year-old self? And he said, that one thing does not necessarily lead to another.
Yes.
So
yeah,
true.
You're
and
right, actually.
Of course, it was amazing. We had incredible opportunities, but we weren't suddenly given carte blanche to do anything we like. And it continues to this day. You're only as good as your last success. And even then, sometimes you have to remind people that it was a success. You do obviously get a sympathetic ear, but you have to, you know, you don't just walk into these things. Making Sherlock, for instance, was the commission was the most amazingly straightforward thing I'll ever happen to me. Modern Sherlock Holmes, yes, that's how it went. But the actual process of getting everyone to agree on the format, on the casting and everything was as difficult as anything ever is. And then, of course, in retrospect, it all looks very straightforward because it looks like the natural order of things. But that's why if you have a proven hit, they tend to leave you alone more because it's obviously working.
Yeah.
Whereas at the initial stage, nobody knows. Nobody knows anything.
Yeah.
As William Goldman wisely said. And so the things that look obvious at the time are like really risky or.
And Sherlock Holmes was risky for you and Stephen Moffat to take that on.
You just have to make it for yourself.
Mm.
If you start focus grouping things or second guessing, then you've not done. You've lost, haven't you? So you have to. We thought the show was very good, but we had no idea it was going to become this international phenomenon. And one of the frustrating things was, a valuable lesson in how these things work. So we made what was essentially a pilot, although it wasn't meant to be a pilot. We got the last bit of money for the year, because it was the whole thing happened quite late.
Yeah.
To make what was planned to be the first hour-long episode of a six-hour series, and that became the pilot. And then the BBC agreed to a series if we did them as 90-minute episodes, because Wallander, which they just done, had been a big success in that slot. Mm. So we said yes. But as a result, the press decided that the pilot had been a disaster. And it was, I mean, eventually I insisted that we put it on the DVD because I wanted people to see that it was very good, but it was just, we just remade it because we had to change the format and the director wasn't available, so we got someone else and all these. But I mean, it's a lesson in how the press can instantaneously distort something, and you have no right of reply pre-Twitter. You have nothing.
Yeah.
It just becomes the narrative, and because it suits, it's obviously a juicy story. Yeah. It's like this fucking thing with Rule Britannia now. The way that that has become,
yes,
you know, Johnson slides out of his hole to have an opinion about that, but not about A-levels or 45,000 dead. But mm-hmm. he can have a fucking opinion on Rule Britannia, which they can't sing because there aren't any people in the hall, and people believe it. That's the horrific thing. It's deadly. It really is deadly. The extent, I think, to which this country has become and is increasingly going to become a sort of Disneyland version of itself that is just boiled down to red buses and bobbies on the beat and Downton kind of cliches of what we are and what we used to be. You know, it's awful.
I suppose
it's Rebecca Front, everybody, ladies and gentlemen. It's Rebecca Front. We're doing a podcast. This is like a celeb meeting.
Rebecca.
Hello.
Hi. We can't shake hands. Rebecca, I'm going to make
you're
you
next.
Come on now. Look, you're next.
You can just carry on. This is Bob.
We'll hand over the relay. Look at Bob. This is Raymond. I'm afraid he's too wimpy to walk. You're going to have a little walk now, Ray. He's shamed himself.
I mean, they both are. They're all one.
No, but Bob's a proper dog.
How are you?
Yeah, very good. How are you?
Surviving.
Mad, isn't it?
Yes.
It's all been a bit bonkers.
Yeah.
But you don't need to hear about this.
Take care. See, I'll drop you a line.
I'll be listening.
Bye.
I have listened. It's a great idea.
Oh, Rebecca, nice to see you.
Bye. There you are. Next one. Easy. Lined up.
Well done.
That
Mark.
Could like a relay. Could be like a relay in future, couldn't it?
She's ever so nice, isn't she?
She's
I
a
really
wonderful
like
man.
Her. So, with Sherlock, this people often focus on the fact that how you and Stephen have presented him, I suppose, which I personally love, is just that he's sort of other in a good way, in a way that I think is celebrated. That he's sort of not neurotypical. And I know this sounds weird, but I was diagnosed with ADHD when I was older. And I remember I'd watched Sherlock before, and I'm sure loads of people felt this. I remember thinking, oh, I do that. I'm sure everyone felt that watching it. I go and shake hands with someone, I get distracted, and then I hyper-focus, and I miss appointments because I'm thinking about the shoes someone's got. And I thought, oh, well, okay, this is quite cool to be like this. I suppose that wasn't your idea to set out to make...
No, because you're not... I mean, the thing is, it's all in Conan Doyle. It's like you can diagnose in whatever way you want, I think. But the point is, clearly, Doyle, who was a practicing GP, an ophthalmic expert, but actually, you know, a very, very clever man, he knew people, perhaps it was even in himself, who suffered from some kind of mania. That's what Holmes does.
Yeah.
And you know, my favourite bit is a child when Sherlock would just sit on the sofa for 3 days in his dressing gown and not move, not eat. And it's clearly based on it's a real condition.
Yeah.
It's not specifically anything, I think. It's just, he's all brain. That's what he says. His body's just basically an engine. Mm. It's just an appendage to his brain. All he cares about is thinking and problems. And so within that, you know, there's a range, there's a spectrum of different conditions that covers, isn't it? And but especially, I think, the highs and lows, the sorts of bipolar aspect of it. That's really familiar. And it's all on the page. It's not, So you don't. We didn't have to set out sort of saying, oh, we're going to make this Sherlock Holmes bipolar or
give him a condition, yeah.
Give him a condition in that way, because it's too limiting, actually, as well. Obviously, you know, he's a genius. He's particular. And therefore, that's what makes him special. But actually, I mean, and without having to make it into a cause, the idea that then that could be something you could celebrate is rather lovely. And also, you think about, at last, a bin. When you think about representation or the things that you wanted to see as a kid which you didn't see, then it's marvellous if people can look at that and say, oh, that's me, or that's cool. Look, suddenly I'm cool. It's like seeing someone with glasses on.
Yeah.
Used to be. For me, it was like, it doesn't have to be a direct correlation. You don't say, oh, that's, I'm exactly like that, and therefore you can just read into it different things about otherness or not being conventional in some way. Everybody, I think, looks for those things when they're growing up.
Did you feel, as a gay man, did you feel that growing up? Did you feel different?
Yes, but it's a strange, this is a really interesting thing, this, because I sought out any kind of representation on the telly. I mean, I've got photographic memories of certain plays for today, which had a vaguely gay theme, because I would just watch, you know, it was just like, it's like someone just suddenly opening a little secret door into something and then slamming it shut. I remember some of those things so well. But then weirdly, equally, I didn't feel antipathy towards Larry Grayson or John Inman or Dick Emery.
Right.
For taking the piss out of it. It was, but then, you know, that's obviously because it wasn't used as a bullying tool, which it might have been for some. But it's interesting, I was talking to Simon Callow a few months ago, because I watched this really good documentary about Larry Grayson. And Simon was he was in Gay Sweatshop and those early gay theatre groups. And I was saying how brilliant Larry Grayson was. He's an incredibly funny man. And Simon said, you see, the thing is, I can only think of him as the enemy. And I was very struck by that, you know, generationally, it can mean something. What they were trying to do was absolutely fight that thing. Mm. Mm. And actually, interestingly, it sort of, in a way, still goes on, because you might think that having Craig Revel-Horwood and Bruno Toglioni on Strictly mainstream Saturday night is in some ways this wonderful advance, because there's two very openly gay men on mainstream telly. But I was saying this to a friend a few years ago, and he said, but don't you think they're kind of like, in the same sort of Inman Grayson way, they become like pet gays? And I thought, you know, there is something to be said for that. That it's a sort of, there's something sort of tamed and neutered about them.
Yeah, it's the camp friend in the Disney film.
Yeah.
You know, who doesn't have a sex life.
Yes, yes.
You know, you must never allude to the sex life. And did you come out to your parents, Mark? Did you just tell them? Was that easy to do?
It happened, I was about 20, I think. It was a lot later than I planned, but you know, you never want to actually do it. You sit there and sort of mouthing it, thinking, I could do it now. And then it was one night, I was home from college, I think, and my mum just suddenly, after tea, said, you've got a lot of friends who are girls. You don't seem to be interested. Are you not interested in girls? And it was like, that was it. And so we had a big talk. And then my dad was in the front room. And she said, I said, I better go and tell your daddy. She said, no, it'll kill him. So I didn't. And then I went back. And I was on the phone to her about a week later. And she said, I remember this so well. She said something like, oh, your Uncle Jack came round. We've had snow. I told your dad. She just dropped it in. So I was sort of, I was denied my moment, but of course was hugely relieved. Mm. But then in a funny way, I then had to sort of do it all again, because it had been mentioned and then shut in a drawer. Mm. And I thought, well, that's not really coming out then, is it? If it's just sort of mentioned once and then we never talk about it. My sister came out in hives. She had,
did she?
Not because she was just shocked, and she had a physical reaction to it. It was extraordinary. my brother had always known. And but it was fine. And actually, I don't have much patience with people who say that coming out isn't the thing it used to be, because everyone's experience is different. And you know, it just, you might think that everyone in an age of social media has incredibly supportive friends and family, and it's not the case. You know, there are still plenty of people who were chucked out or never spoken to again. Particularly, I think increasingly what you're aware of is from people from a different culture or a religious background whose parents simply find it unacceptable. That was something that didn't impinge on our consciousness in the same way before.
Yeah.
So it's still very much not a straightforward process.
So Mark, you're a writer, you're a creator, you're an actor, you're everything. And you often get called Renaissance man because you, and I know sometimes I've seen you react to that and go, well, I don't know how I feel about that.
I would say, so is Cesare Borgia. That's who I aspire to be. It's sometimes a lack of focus. But I'm just very interested in lots of things. And I find it, one of the great joys of my career, I can say that now, has been the wonderful opportunities I've been offered. And then someone says, BBC Bristol say, do you want to do a three-part landmark series about the history of horror films? I'm going to go, yes, I would. And some things like that have just been wonderful. And actually what I've done increasingly, I've done two documentaries about artists, John Minton and Aubrey Beardsley. And that, again, has been fabulous. I mean, they're just they're passion projects. And actually to talk about stuff like that is such a privilege. It's, you know, it's just so interesting. And I love it. You meet amazing people, go to amazing places, and but it's kind of got something. I mean, it's got heart to it, and it's about something. It's not just, you know, going abroad for the sake of it or anything like that.
So your 16-year-old boyhood self with Doctor Who, and I suppose with Sherlock, that's a lovely gift you gave that boy.
My 8-year-old self, I would say.
Eight's
the prime age, but absolutely no. I mean, I never in my wildest dreams thought I'd actually get to write for Doctor Who, because it came off the air. I thought that was it, and Sherlock Holmes similarly is a boyhood passion. You know, you just, who knows, these things are going to happen. So yeah, it is. I mean, that's what I've said this a lot, but, you know, if I really could go back in time and show my 8-year-old self this, it would blow his head. It's just amazing. And I think the thing that excites me, though, which wouldn't have excited me then, I think, because children are inherently more conservative, is the idea of contributing to these things in a sort of ongoing way. That it's not just about bringing back your old favourites, it's about trying to push the envelope so you're constantly doing new stuff. Because, and I say this all the time, as a desperately nostalgic child, even when I was too young to be, the thing is you can't create nostalgia without creating new things. And I do get very impatient sometimes with people who just, and this is back to where we are with the state of this country, there never was a golden age in any respect. There were, some things were good, some things were bad. It's always the same way. But you can't get back to that happy feeling, that happy place, just by slavishly repeating things. If you don't push forward, you're dead. Barry Cryer, one of the greatest comic minds this country has ever produced, one of the things I absolutely love about Barry is that he never looks back. You know, he wrote gags for Frankie Howard. He's worked with all the giants, but he's constantly fascinated by anything new. And it keeps him young, and it keeps the whole idea young, you know. So I think what we did with Sherlock was trying to restore it to its factory settings, as it were, by taking away the thing that was getting in the way. And getting back to this idea of it basically being a sort of odd couple flat share. And people responded to it because they saw it new. And in fact, one of the great joys was people going, oh my God, I didn't realise that was from the stories. And you go, yeah, it's all there. You just, no one's told this story for a long time, you know.
Mark, tell me how you met your husband, Ian.
20 years now.
What, really?
We met in a bank heist. He was the driver. I was the sort of, you know, front man. We met online.
Oh, you were an early adopter, Mark.
Very early adopter, yes. Before it was basically what everyone does now. Very strange thing. We didn't tell our parents or our families for donkeys because it was still very much infradig. Of course, now it's literally what everybody does because of obviously it's the only sensible thing to do. I think I might try and find someone I have something in common with rather than randomly hoping I meet the love of my life in a sleazy bar.
You work hard, don't you? You've got a strong work ethic.
I do work hard. It's good though, it's good for you. What else is there to do? I think sometimes I'm getting a lot better at relaxing. Reading a wonderful new book about Agatha Christie, and her work rate in the 30s is so astonishing. It's astonishing. What she should have done actually was sat on some of these books and then released them later. Yeah. She often wrote 4 books a year, the very best she ever did. It's amazing.
Really?
But at the same time, it's also really good to take long walks and just lie down and think about other stuff and do nothing.
Do you find Bob good for that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, again, one of the great joys of... Look at that. No, they.
Is that Akita? Akita?
No, a Husky.
Oh, Husky. Yeah.
She needs a halti like Bob because that dog is pulling badly.
Yeah. There's a lot of those huskies since Game of Thrones, which, I mean, you come out with a sentence and it turns out there's a 90% chance Mark was in it, whatever you mentioned.
I don't know about that. You see, but I saw someone on Twitter the other day saying they were debating. There's a new version of All Creatures Great and Small, and Sam West is playing Siegfried, and someone had said, I wish that was Mark Gatiss. And Sam is wonderful. I literally saw him the other day and he's perfect for Siegfried. But someone replied, I like them both, but I think Mark's in everything. I thought, I'm really not. I don't think,
no.
I haven't been on the telly for about 2 years.
I wouldn't describe you as in everything at all. Mm. I would describe you as in everything good.
Do. Oh, that's good.
Mark, I've only ever heard nice things about you, I have to tell you. You've never seemed to have left a sense of who you are. You seem quite authentic.
Well, I hope so. My motto is work hard, don't be a and I don't think you can say fairer than that. But there are, and most people are. Most people are.
I think so.
Yeah, definitely. There aren't very many, and you know when you see them. But also, it's so exhausting. I mean, the effort that some people must put into being not nice. And, I used to think it's about Michael Jackson. I used to think he'd sometimes wake up having had so many procedures on his face and just think, I wish I'd never started this. And I sometimes think that about really nasty people.
Yeah.
It must be so exhausting that they come home and close the door behind them and think, oh God. Unless they're visited by three spirits, which
yes.
is the way out.
Yeah. Which, actually, such a pro, Mark, because that brings us to Christmas Carol, which you have been writing, and I was really dying to see.
Next Christmas.
And it's going to be next Christmas, is it?
Touch wood. Mm. I mean, who knows? We're all... let's sit here.
Oh,
The thing I'm worried about is that there seems to be a collective idea that once we get to New Year's Eve, everything's going to be all right. The pandemic does not respect dates. Sit. Come on.
I thought you were doing that to me, Mark. I thought, oh, he's got a bit Donald Trump.
Come on. Bob, get up. Get up here. Come on, you idiot.
Bob.
Sit on here.
Come on, darling.
Right, there we go.
Oh, my God.
Shh.
Yes, darling. Good boy.
Sit.
I thought that thing you did to start for Stand Up To Cancer was so incredible, Mark. Described how you lost your mum to cancer and then your sister. And I just think it was amazing that you did that.
Well, you know, the strange thing about those things is you kind of... you want to do something and there's nothing much you can do apart from contribute and donate. So talking about it was... a way of doing that, I guess. And then I suppose the surprise is, if you found this, but you sort of end up just spilling your guts. I mean, I don't know quite what I thought I'd say, but I just said it all. And it was very cathartic. It was, I mean, I suppose that's the thing that you live with, isn't it?
Is,
and I do think about this, the way that you end up coping, and is, but the danger is you stop talking about them.
Yeah.
And it's really good. It was very cathartic, and I enjoyed coming out of it the other end.
Yes.
I felt much better.
Good.
Because the danger is and this goes back to what my dad's sort of attitude is much more about compartmentalizing things and shutting them away, and it's
was
not
it?
Good for you. You know, you need to talk about it. Not obviously not all the time, because you can't live in the past and you can't be internally maudlin, but
no.
It's really important. It's like looking at pictures or watching old films or something that you just actually do mention them,
yeah,
rather than just as a sort of casual glance at a picture every now and then. Amazingly, here is Ian.
Bob went straight to Ian.
Hello.
Hello.
Do you want to take him and we'll finish off?
Bob's going off with Ian now. What does that mean for Bob, Ian? Does that mean he's going to get treats?
No, because I don't
I've got them.
I don't have any on me.
Is Ian a good cop or bad cop? Out of you two, who's strict dad and who's...
No, we're not strict.
Well, it's kind of equal, isn't it?
Yeah.
He's kind of equal with his affection. When we're doing yoga in the morning, I don't know if Mark said this, but he'll kind of come and lie on each of us in turn. He doesn't have a favourite.
That's just because he wants to be fed. We started this in lockdown, yoga with Adrian, because it was important to give some structure to the entirely nebulous days.
Yeah.
But we're keeping it up. It's good for you.
Come on, then.
Nice to meet you.
Bye, Bob. Go on.
To go back to what you were saying earlier, I totally agree with you, and I find, exactly like you, just now it gets easier because it's been a while for me. I don't know how long it's been for you, but I lost my sister... I guess it was 2012, so it was about 8 years ago.
10 years.
Ten years.
Yeah.
And you feel... Oh, yours was 10 years, you're saying, yeah. So similar. And I always... There are ways people describe it, aren't they? Like, people say you dance again, but you've got a slight limp and all this kind of stuff. And I like to think, I remember her and I remember my mum, but I remember the funny bits more now.
You find... This actually wasn't long after my mum had died, but one of the things we loved watching when I was a kid was Lily, the Lily Langtry story with Francesca Annis. And it came out on DVD and I was in the shop and I just thought, oh, I must get that from... I remember stopping myself and thinking, oh my God. It was just such a natural thing to think,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And it still happens. You just trip yourself up, don't you? But then it's increasingly in a sort of warm way you kind of... But I think it's very important to not just steamroller on and think that's over, that's gone, because it's you're just then denying their existence. And also you want to allow yourself a good cry sometimes, or not even that, or a good laugh. You know, just a, I've said this before, but the week my mum, when my mum was dying, it was one of the closest times we've ever had as a family. We sat around the bed swapping stories and we'd taken turns to make sandwiches and cups of tea, and it was great fun, and we just sort of laughed over her, you know, and talked to her, and it was really important. And when she went, it was a real wrench about that as well. There was like a moment that just popped, went, and I think that's pretty good for people. But as you said, it's a club that everyone eventually joins, and if people don't understand it, it's because they haven't had the misfortune to join it yet. But they'll go through it because everybody does, and again, everyone reacts in a different way, I suppose. You find yourself missing odd little things, or you have some very strong pang of memory or some fuzzy little thing that joins the dots and you go, oh gosh, remember that? And I was visiting my dad recently, and you know, he's got early stage dementia, and he's fine, but it's much easier to talk to him about the past.
Mm.
And with some of which he remembers in extraordinary clarity, and it's really, really rather nice, because it's not you're not trying to piece something together, you're actually talking about very specific memories. And it's amazingly helpful to talk about childhood holidays, and which suddenly spring into life like that, you know, because there's particular things which anchor you, I guess.
Is your dad conscious, do you think, of the losses? So he's aware of it?
Yeah, my brother, who lives only a mile away, so he sees him every day, he said he's occasionally forgotten. I mean, I presume it'll get worse, but
yeah.
At the moment, no, he's very aware.
Mm.
And he talks about them in the past, but he definitely has forgotten a couple of times.
Yeah, yeah.
But then that's the way it goes. You know, this is sort of, it's a sort of strange roller coaster of. He gets very frustrated with himself.
Sometimes people would say to me, "Oh, I'm so lucky that hasn't happened to me." And I, you know, especially with my sister, because it does feel a bit odd. It's a life interrupted as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
And she had kids, and I would say, well, I'm Christmas future, really. So
yeah. Christmas yet to come.
Yeah.
I hate to be pedantic, but it's Christmas yet to come. no, absolutely.
Anyone was going to correct me.
That's a terrible thing.
Christmas yet to
say,
come.
But it's true. And also, I thought there's a lot. Oh, my sister died, and then unfortunately, terribly, her husband died 2 years later of a stroke.
Oh, no.
And so my nephews were orphaned, and it's an extraordinary Dickensian, oddly enough, Dickensian sort of situation. But I remember thinking very strongly at the time that if you reach, my dad's nearly 90, if you reach that age, you're still going, and you've vaguely got your wits, that's a real blessing.
It's
the really outrageous thing is people going in their 50s and stuff, or younger. It's just not fair. Otherwise, you know, you can't complain. That's a great lifespan, a lot of good times, a lot of amazing things to have. But it's the interruption, as you say, that feels so unfair.
But I do think, and I suppose this is as good a place as any to end it, because you need to go and see that nice friend in Ian. I think the stuff that you've done throughout your career, whether you're acting or writing or creating, I love the fact that you explore that side of humanity and life. Sometimes it is dark, and life is dark, and I believe in order to appreciate the light, you have to have that as well. Mm. I don't think you can have one without the other, personally.
I agree.
Do you?
Bittersweet. That's what it's all about. It's not even a sort of mission statement. That's what life's like. And sometimes I think those kind of... It seems a weird thing to say. It's one of the great triumphs of latter-day Disney is they have finally embraced that. From being genuinely the creators of Pollyanna, from being this sort of outrageously saccharine, white picket fence kind of machine, they have properly embraced wonderful films like Inside Out, you know? Or Coco. Have you seen Coco?
No, I need to see that. Is it incredible?
It's a film about death. It's a children's film about death.
Oh, I love it.
And incredibly celebratory, but that's what it's about.
Mm.
And, you know, that has to be what all good stuff is about, I think.
Yeah.
It's both things at the same time, because that's what life is. And I love... All of my favourite things have aspects of that. They have pathos and broad humour. They have light and shade, because, you know... It's also like the false distinction between gritty drama and comedy. You know, gritty drama tends to win the big BAFTAs because it's like unremittingly bleak. The best stuff is bleak and silly at the same time, because that's what happens.
Mark, you said at the beginning or at some point during our chat that you found it hard to say no, and I can see that. And I don't want to be responsible for you being nice and sitting here when you've got your lovely husband and your nice friend, and they need you now because I've had my time with you. I've loved meeting you. We can't hug, but can we elbow?
You can. It's all we can do these days.
Can you give Ray a...
Ray, stroke? However, can get it all. Ray gets all the affection.
Yes.
I really hope you enjoyed listening to that, and do remember to rate, review and subscribe on iTunes.